Is the state of Florida finally getting serious about addressing climate change? Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect. Thanks for being with us. Just ahead this morning, why the city and the state of Florida are facing increasing pressure on the climate change issue. You can join us. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, a local photographer introduces Jacksonville to Jacksonville in the pages of his new book. But first this morning, a group of local scientists, scholars, and citizens recently sent a letter to Jacksonville Mayor Lenny Curry asking him to develop a climate action plan for Jacksonville, one that would set the goals of reducing emissions, adapting to climate changes, and creating a more resilient community. So far, the mayor hasn't responded. Meantime, state leaders are finally looking more seriously at this issue of climate change after years of basically ignoring it. There's a public workshop coming up in this city tomorrow night that you can be part of on climate. All of this as the Trump administration announced this week they are formally withdrawing from the Paris Climate Accord. We're going to talk climate change on the show today as we welcome Dr. Quentin White, director of JU's Marine Science Research Institute. Good morning.
Good morning.
Dr. Adam Rosenblatt with the Department of Biology at UNF.
Good morning.
And our own WJCT environmental reporter, Brendan Rivers.
Hey.
Here's our question to callers. What do you think Florida needs to be doing to get serious about addressing climate change? It's 549-2937. Give us a call. 549-2937. Emails to First Coast Connect at WJCT.org. Tweets to at Melissa N. Jacks. And our Facebook page is open. All right, Dr. Adam Rosenblatt of UNF, let's start with you. Tell us about the letter you and some colleagues sent Mayor Curry. What did you say to him?
So we sent this letter to the mayor and also to every member of city council. And what we were asking is for them to prioritize the development of a comprehensive climate action plan for the city. Currently, Jacksonville is the only major city that doesn't have something like this sort of in development. Miami has had something. They've had a climate action plan since, I think, 2010. Tampa has had a Office of Sustainability and Resiliency for a while now. And even Orlando has been thinking about this issue for at least the last, 5 years. But Jacksonville doesn't seem to have anything similar. And so we'd like the mayor and the city council to really try to make some headway on this, because it's going to help ensure that the city is viable for the future if we have a climate action plan and we can prepare for what's going to come.
What was the response from the mayor and the city council?
The mayor hasn't responded yet. This was all started maybe about 3 weeks ago. We haven't heard from the mayor. I've heard from about four city council members, two of whom have scheduled meetings with me face to face. And hopefully, we can get the conversation started in city council and get some more progress on the issue.
There are a couple of local committees that have been meeting on resiliency and how to protect Jacksonville from flooding. They are going to recommend that Jacksonville hire a chief resilience or sustainability officer, among other changes. How important is that? We're the only major city in Florida without that, correct?
Yeah, that's incredibly important. What a CRO does, a chief resilience officer, is they are somebody who's at a high level of city government, and they're able to look at the whole picture, right? The big picture when it comes to climate change. And they help coordinate all of the different city agencies, all the different state agencies, all the different stakeholders who are concerned about climate change and going to be affected by it. And they can coordinate those activities and bring resources to bear so that they can prepare adequately.
We did have a resiliency person.
Yes.
At one point.
Yes.
But then we didn't.
Yes.
Isn't that right?
It is. I know that was before I actually got to Jacksonville, so I don't know the whole story there, but actually I was reading some older articles by WJCT, and
yep,
that apparently there was a CRO, I think, at the beginning of 2016, but that when Mayor Curry was elected, he dissolved that position.
Okay. It's 549-2937 to join us. Dr. Quint White, you lead Jacksonville's Marine Science Research Institute. You are going to be hosting an event on the JU campus, actually tomorrow.
Correct.
Letting folks weigh in on this issue. What's going to be happening?
Correct. Actually, JU and the Marine Science Research Institute is co-sponsoring a workshop with a group called the Florida Ocean Alliance. The Florida Ocean Alliance is a nonprofit, nonpartisan group that involves both academic, state regulatory agencies, trade organizations, boat manufacturers, cruise ship industries, things like that. It's a pretty broad group. Been trying to talk with the state for a number of years about trying to step back and do a strategic plan for the state. Mm-hmm. The The state of Florida is closely tied to the ocean, and what happens to the ocean here has a global effect. And so the idea is to take a step back, look at what can we do to help protect our ocean. We're looking at issues like climate change and sea level rise, which are very real issues. The data is overwhelming. But we're also going to look at water quality, harmful algae blooms, all the things that are affecting the local economy and the state economy. Something like 80% of Florida's economy is tied to the ocean in some respect. And there are well over 1 million jobs in the state of Florida tied to the ocean. And so it's important to understand that there is a very close relationship between the economy and the environment. And this is the thing that I think sometimes our politicians sort of lose sight of, that this is an economic issue as well as an environmental issue, and we need to pay attention to it.
Certainly, former governor, now Senator Rick Scott, took a lot of criticism for basically ignoring climate change as an important issue. He even instructed his staff not to say the words climate change, according to media reports. Governor Ron DeSantis has been a lot more proactive about climate change. He's hired a state science officer, a state resilience officer. How would you grade the DeSantis administration so far and the legislature on looking at this issue more seriously?
Well, in terms of Governor DeSantis, I'm very pleased that he's beginning to take action. Maybe I'll give him a B+, A minus. And I do that just because thus far we haven't had any action. We've got these moves, but until the legislature really begins to take action, I don't think we're going to see a whole lot. I think one of the things that concerns me is that we're not seeing the kind of national long-term leadership that we need. And we haven't, until recently, seen anything at the state level, and we're still not seeing much at the local level. And so until we get somebody who can really step up and begin to focus on the long-term impacts, I'm starting to worry more as I sort of begin to wind down my career, that we're in a position in which we have the potential to leave the world and even our local environment in worse shape than we found it. And it bothers me that I may not be preparing the world to host my grandchildren as well as my grandfather did to host me in that respect.
That's what this is all about. Brendan Rivers, our environmental reporter. This is about leaving planet Earth in livable shape for our kids and grandkids. Let's talk about the fact that the Trump administration just announced it's formally withdrawing from the 2015 Paris Climate Accords. We're virtually the only nation on Earth now, the only advanced nation, who's not participating in these accords. And we did see Governor DeSantis say, well, this is a global issue, not a state issue. He sort of brushed aside the need for Florida to undergo carbon emissions reduction initiatives. That's one example.
Right. And that's an argument I frequently hear. Basically every level of government is people say, if others aren't doing it, what's the point in us doing it? And this is a point you brought up, Adam, when we spoke about the letter earlier, and you made the exact opposite point. How can we expect others to do this if we don't take on a leadership role and do it first? And it seems odd to me, that argument, because most of the time with issues that have a global impact, Americans tend to take pride in taking leadership and being the first to really like dig in and try to find a solution. And a lot of times it's almost treated as a race. I mean, think about the race to get to the moon first, you know. So why is it so different when it comes to issues like climate change and the environment?
I'd also like to point out that it's a bit of a myth that others are not, putting efforts towards, other countries aren't putting efforts towards this issue. One of the things I frequently hear is, why should the United States be doing anything if China and India aren't going to be taking, you know, aggressive actions? And the reality is that they actually are taking aggressive actions in a number of respects. When it comes to China, they are investing annually 3 times as much money in renewable energy development as the United States is. We're not meeting the challenge at the moment.
Okay, what are your thoughts about this, both in terms of what's not being done locally on climate change, how the state is responding, how the nation is responding, and the world? Give us a call, 549-2937. Christine is on the South Side. Hi, Christine. Good morning. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. It's a pleasure to hear these educated people speaking so logically. I can never understand the illogic and the partisanship tied to something so fundamental as the right to breathe and have clean air and water. As far as Florida goes, why aren't we reinvesting back into renewable resources such as solar power and even wind power? We have two huge bodies of water hugging the state. I just got back from Copenhagen, and it's beautiful, the amount of energy that they produce with very little impact to the environment. Same with solar. Are we not reinvesting in the infrastructure to buy back the electric and help the companies and disperse that energy and lower our costs?
Okay, Christine, yeah, thank you for all of those thoughts. Quint White. It's going to be a tough sell in the legislature to get Florida fully on that train of investing more heavily in renewables and reducing emissions.
Yeah, I agree. And it's a struggle. I don't understand either. Again, as I sort of pointed out, we tie the environment to the economy so closely. And why we're not investing more in renewable energy, it's beyond me. The train has left the station in many respects for continued use of coal and oil. The rest of the world, and in fact, much of the country, is beginning to move more and more towards renewable energy. Solar is becoming more economical. Wind is a possibility. You know, we have hydroelectric power in other places. And so I don't fully understand why politicians, and why it's become sort of partisan. I agree with the caller that this should be a nonpartisan issue. We want to have clean water. We want to have clean air. We want to have affordable energy that people can use and rely on. And so we need to think about that. JEA, our local power authority, has actually taken steps to decrease the amount of individual use of power, because they now make it so with net metering so that it doesn't become economically viable for somebody to invest in the solar panels in order to use.
Yeah. If you want to put solar on your roof, they've actually made it harder.
Yeah. It's going to cost you money. When we built the Marine Science Research Institute, we looked at it, and I had to say that I couldn't justify the cost because I couldn't recoup the investment over a period of time, a reasonable period of time. So it's one of these conundrums I don't understand. It's almost like, well, if the Democrats suggested that Republicans got against it, and the Republicans suggested the Democrats got to be against it. You know, at some point, we've got to understand that we're in this together, and we need clean air, we need clean water. And as we oftentimes say,
we need to protect our coastlines from being swamped,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, exactly. And so this idea that it's not a local problem, yeah, the old adage, think globally, act locally. The globe doesn't emit things. Emission comes from individual sources. And so we need to sort of think about that and how we can do that. The advent of electric-powered cars moves some of that material from one source to another source. And so we got to sort of think through that. It's sort of the same problem we have with water quality, because as we brought more and more people together in smaller and smaller places, we've generated waste products that then have to be disposed of, and they're being put into our waterways in many cases, and that's leading to problems. This is, you know, one of the many topics that we think we should address as part of the strategic plan, and that's what the workshop tomorrow night is at JU. Starts at 6 o'clock at the Institute, and invite anybody who wants to be part of that and contribute to a strategic plan for the state of Florida to come and participate.
They should come out to that. Meanwhile, Brendan Rivers, the state's Public Service Commission, is actually meeting this week about energy issues. What's happening?
Yeah, so that's actually today.
And today.
Yeah, so I think it starts at 10. So as soon as we get done here, I'm going to run over to my desk and try to record that. But they're expected to make two decisions today. One is related to the energy efficiency. So all these utilities in the state have proposed energy efficiency goals for the next decade. Many of them proposed goals of zero gains energy efficiency, including JEA.
Zero gains.
Zero gains energy efficiency. So today, the Public Service Commission is expected to. People are expecting them to approve those goals. They're also expected to make a decision on whether utilities can put in the rates for their customers, the cost to bury power lines. So that's another big decision they're supposed to be making today.
All right. Let's go to Rob in Avondale. Hi, Rob. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to add to some of the comments Christine was making about the partisan divide and the curiosity of it. Good companies evolve. And if Exxon was still in Texas drilling holes into nothing, if taxis didn't admit that Uber exists and we're still doing things the old way, they wouldn't be in business. And now you're starting to see the benefit of that competition or change in the market, where you get into a taxi, you can pay with your credit card, you can call them, you can start to have some of the same features. So the complaint that companies typically voice is how onerous these environmental precautions are, how upgrading their utilities is going to be difficult and expensive. Well, there's two things. Tough crap, that's evolution. Like, that's how you maintain relevance in a market that's going to change. We're not burning coal anymore. But secondly, there's a lot of opportunity for economic development and thriving financials in that evolution. And I think what we need to do is to, yes, steer away from the partisan divide and start focusing on how certain kinds of behaviors by companies should be rewarded and others should be penalized.
All right. Thanks for that, Rob. Lots of calls coming into the show. Lewis in Arlington. Go ahead, Lewis.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. Go ahead.
I'm enjoying the conversation this morning, and I initially had some things I wanted to say, knew what I wanted to say, but as the conversation has evolved, I've kind of changed on that. One of the observations I'd like to make is that the across-the-board denial of climate change by the Republican Party stymies pretty much anything that we try to do as long as we have Lenny Curry in office, because he rides that political wagon. And it is, sorry, I was distracted by guards at an entrance.
That's all right. Go ahead.
We are, we're surrounded by water on three sides. We are going to experience climate change firsthand before a lot of other parts of the country, as other parts of the world already are. And yet we have this attitude, well, China doesn't do their share or someone else doesn't do their share. Well, we're not going to do ours. That is, I think my mom used to call it cutting off your nose to spite your face. There's no forward planning, no thought for the future. And when you have the president that denies climate change and we have such a poorly educated populace that they believe in, we're in trouble and we need to do something quickly or it's going to be irreversible.
Thank you, Lewis. Certainly won't get any argument out of the panelists here. Dr. Rosenblatt, here at the local level, beyond sending the letter to city leaders, what else do you plan to do to follow up?
The following up, I mean, so the conversation has started. A couple of city council members want to get the information that we've presented in front of the rest of city council and hopefully in front of the mayor so that they can make some informed decisions about this. I just want to follow up on something the caller said, which is that, you know, the news this morning of the Trump administration, you know, formally starting the process of pulling out of the Paris Climate Accords, there's a clear, you know, abdication of leadership at the national level on this issue. It's basically this administration abandoning coastal cities like ours, right? Jacksonville is a uniquely vulnerable city in a uniquely vulnerable state when it comes to flooding and sea level rise. And so it just puts the onus on us to even put more effort into acting locally, right? Nobody's going to ride in on a white horse and save us. We have to, at the state level, at the city level, we have to take actions. And that's why we're asking the city council and the mayor to really make this a priority.
You know, a recent study looking at coastal cities and seawalls, I believe, found that Jacksonville would be the most expensive city in America to protect from rising waters if it's decided that seawalls are the way to go. Quint White, we have the most coastline of any city in America, not just oceanfront, but inland riverfront.
Yeah, we have over 1,100 miles of shoreline in the city, and that's probably a very conservative number, 75 square miles of open water. You know, we oftentimes talk about the fact that the state of Florida is surrounded on three sides by water. Actually, I think it's actually we're completely surrounded by water. If you think about the aquifer underneath us and the moisture in the atmosphere above us that comes down in the form of rain, so that things we put in the atmosphere come back to us in terms of increased particulates and acidity in the rainwater. So, you know, we are so tightly tied to water that it's ridiculous that we have people sort of denying that relationship.
I want to make a shameless plug, too, for our digital magazine, Adapt Florida. Brendan did almost all of the work on this, but a few of us contributed. If you go to adaptflorida.org, you can learn all about our vulnerable shorelines and some of the adaptation and mitigation efforts that have already started in our area to protect this community.
Can I make a shameless plug as well?
Sure.
Just in the interest of being, you know, presenting some positive things that people could do, because obviously we're in a dire situation. We need fast action. There's a couple things that people can do here in Jacksonville to get involved locally. One is obviously voting for politicians who see that climate change is a serious issue. Second thing is, you know, writing and emailing and calling your local elected officials to let them know you care about this. And then the last thing is that I am one of the co-leaders of a local group called Citizens Climate Lobby. It's part of a national organization that works. It's a nonpartisan organization, and it works to get national politicians to pay attention to climate change and get legislation passed at the national level in Congress. And so if you're interested in getting involved with that, you know, we have an active local organization that you could contribute to. You can look us up on Facebook at Citizens Climate Lobby.
All right. Karen is in San Marco. Hey, Karen, good morning.
Good morning. I live in San Marco, and I was there during Hurricane Irma, and I saw the damage that occurred in San Marco. Fortunately, we were 24 feet above sea level because we were closer to the Phillips Highway side. But I saw our future in that. And I remember going to a meeting with Dr. White, and I had asked him what the people who were building the district, you know, said about the rising water. And he told me that their plan was to re-engineer themselves out of it. And I thought, there's my answer as to what the city's probably going to do. You know, they're going to start raising our taxes, charging a lot of money for seawalls to keep it out. Instead of moving people off land that's flooding now, or not building on land that's going to flood. And so my husband and I are seriously considering leaving the state because the government won't do anything. Thank you very much.
Yeah, Karen, thank you. And certainly you're not alone. Others are mulling that over. And, you know, she mentioned San Marco, which, of course, always floods, but it especially suffered after Irma. Just as she was talking, guys, I received an email into my inbox from the Memorial Park Association in Riverside, letting us know that the balustrade along the shoreline there in Memorial Park is going to be repaired shortly. They hope to have it done next year. However, they are still waiting on FEMA funds. That iconic balustrade, which lines the river's edge in Memorial Park, was destroyed after Hurricane Irma. So that's just one example we could point to out of so many of how this city is already feeling these impacts and how those impacts are going to increase. Kind of interesting timing getting that email as we discuss this. Lots of tweets and emails coming into the show. Brian tweets the show, the fact of the matter is that the Paris Climate Accords don't go far enough. We are at the threshold and we are falling short. May tweets us, what is the city's plan to protect our downtown and riverfront? If I'm not mistaken, the bulkhead is only 1 to 2 feet above mean high tide line, and it's worse for king tides. And here are just a few emails. Paula writes, climate change starts with education. We need to educate our kids in school from an early age, and it should be part of the curriculum. Joseph emails us, the U.S. has done much more than China to reduce carbon emissions. He linked to a story from NPR about this. Thanks for that, Joe. And here's an email from Ira. What about JEA? Can a citizen signature petition recall the JEA board? Let's talk about JEA. Sherry is in Arlington and wants to talk about JEA. Hi, Sherry. Go ahead.
Hi there. I think, well, as far as nationally, the person in the White House is, number one, a conspiracy theorist, which is really weird that he doesn't, that he considers this a conspiracy, the climate change, and he's not very educated. Plus, he loves money, and so he's opened up the oil and coal industry more than it ever has been and rolled back so many EPA guidelines. And it all starts from the top. You know, they love money. The whole bunch of leadership, and they're going to go for the easy money. Locally, though, I think that selling JEA is a mistake. We could keep it and start working on renewable energy. And the other thing I had a question about, you mentioned FEMA funds, and it's what do we need to do to get someone on contacting FEMA to get those funds to repair the balustrade?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Okay. So 3 points there from Sherry. Let's start with the JEA matter, guys, as certainly this is controversial locally. A majority of those polled, at least up till now, have said they're not in favor of selling JEA. We should be getting new polling data from UNF later this week on that, by the way, on the JEA question. But how do you see the push to privatize JEA through the prism of climate change and renewable energy? What are your thoughts? Let's start with you, Brendan.
So I've heard over and over and over again, having a city-owned utility tends to be better for the ratepayer. And I've asked about this renewable side of things, and I have not gotten a clear answer. I've asked people who really are experts when it comes to utilities and energy efficiency, and they say there's no clear data to show that a city-owned versus a privately owned is better at these things. It really just kind of depends on who's leading the mm-hmm. organization. So it's hard to say at this point where things could go, but it could be better depending on who buys it.
Dr. Rosenblatt.
I think it's important to recognize that if JEA remains a city-owned utility, then it is more responsible to the citizens, right? It's not necessarily have to be a profit-driven organization. They can be responsive to the concerns of the citizens in the city. Whereas if it's a privately owned utility company, then they can focus just on profit margins, and they don't really have to be concerned as much about the proper mix of energy sources. And I just want to point out that this has already happened in other countries. For example, there's a famous case in Germany where in the 80s and 90s there were lots of local communities in Germany that sold off their public utilities for the short-term monetary gain, right? And then in the decades after that, in the early 2000s and in the 2010s, a lot of those communities wanted to buy their utilities back because they were concerned about these privately held companies not making the right choices when it comes to local issues. And so, you know, my hope would be that we wouldn't, you know, take another 20 or 30 years to go down that same path before we realize that it's a bad idea to privatize a local utility.
Quint White.
Yeah, I echo what has been said. It's all about leadership. And right now we're not seeing the leadership. There's no reason that a locally owned utility cannot succeed in this environment. You know, despite the president's efforts to revive the coal industry, it's just one of the largest coal mining companies just went bankrupt. Coal is diminishing. It's a dying resource. I mean, yes, it's vast out there, but it's a problem when we burn it. Same is happening with oil. We're moving in that direction, and we need our leadership to understand that and get on board. This idea of denial just blows me away. I don't understand it. We educate our children, and our children seem to get it, but our voting public doesn't seem to understand it sometimes. And I'm not exactly sure where we began to vilify science. And it's bothered me a lot recently because I deal in science, I deal in facts. And I've realized in some of the issues I've dealt with, I'm going to use manatees as an example, I sort of realized that if I sort of took the road of science and data, I was going to make both sides mad at me, and that's sort of what happened. And yet, we've watched the manatees recover. And I guess I'm also a perpetual optimist. I feel like we've got a bright future if we just pay attention to the facts and the information, and that we make the right decisions as a community. And we need to get this partisan politics out of the way and understand that it's not all about money, that, again, the economy is important, but the environment is more important.
Tom on the West Side. Go ahead, Tom.
Good morning. Speaking of making right decisions, I've seen an example recently of making wrong decisions. I was going down Riverside just the other day, and there are two new apartment complexes that are built right on the river and probably subject to horrible damage the next time a hurricane comes this way. It just makes no sense.
You know, I think I know the ones you're referring to, Tom. And yeah, so part of becoming a more resilient city, correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. Rosenblatt, is changing building codes in the future so as to either prevent that kind of construction or at least better protect it. Because if it's the one that he's that I think he's referring to, there are ground floor units that are just a foot or two away from the water in that new apartment complex in Riverside, Avondale area.
Yeah, and it's just, it's really irresponsible in a long-term context to build those kinds of structures so close to the water. I mean, you know, you're putting people in harm's way by building those buildings right. and tricking them basically into thinking it's a safe place to live. And it's just not. So yeah, you know, one of the things that the city could do, I know it's a controversial idea because, you know, waterfront property is valuable real estate, but the city could limit development in those areas going into the future and then also update building codes such that city-owned buildings and also new buildings would have to meet, you know, very stringent guidelines for meeting energy efficiency goals. That would be a really big step.
You know, let me just jump in. Brendan, have any Florida cities gone that route? In South Florida, where they're already getting regular sunny day flooding, the building's going right ahead, full steam ahead.
Well, I don't know too much about the specifics in Miami. I know they're doing a lot on this front, but I mean, here in Jacksonville, the Storm Resiliency and Infrastructure Development Review Committee and the Adaptation Action Area Working Group have made suggestions to the city to adjust its building codes and where it allows new development. I think maybe a handful of proposals from the Storm Resiliency Committee have been adopted so far, but otherwise these things have not been taken up by the city council or the mayor yet. I also kind of want to go back to one thing that keeps coming up, and it's this idea of economy versus environment. And I think that's the wrong way to frame things. I think they're very dependent on each other, especially in Florida. I mean, our economy is driven by tourism and people coming here and wanting to live on the water because of the environment we have. So that needs to be preserved. And another thing that just throw out there, I mean, this idea of coal, we need to save coal. Naturally, coal jobs are going away. The two fastest growing jobs in the country right now, of all jobs, are solar installers and wind turbine technicians.
Yeah, right. Exactly. We're getting comments on Facebook, too, about how JEA sale might affect impact fees. I just wanted to throw that in there. People are watching that, too. Okay, Quint White, the big event is tomorrow night at JU. How can people be part of it?
Well, just come out. We're at the university at the Marine Center Church Institute. Come on campus. Come straight down towards the river. Hang a right, and we're sitting off on the river on the left. It starts at 6 o'clock. It's going to be a participatory discussion. If you come, your voice will be heard. We have quite an agenda to try to work through. There are a lot of coastal related issues, not just climate change and sea level rise. I mentioned harmful algae blooms. I mentioned water quality, those kind of things. Also, I want to make sure I do correct something. I never said it was environment versus the economy.
No, it wasn't you.
I think they are tied tightly together, and we have got to make sure that we understand that they're tied tightly together.
Especially here in Florida. Again, that's tomorrow night, 6 p.m. at JU's Marine Science Research Institute. This is a workshop where you can weigh in on Florida's critical ocean and coastal issues. This is through the Florida Ocean Alliance, the state's Environmental Protection Board, Fish and Wildlife. Come on out to this tomorrow night. And thank you, Dr. Quint White of JU, Dr. Adam Rosenblatt of UNF, and our own environmental ace, Brendan Rivers. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And up next, it's a new book, Capturing the Citizens of Jacksonville. We'll look at Create Jax next.
Somewhere over the rainbow, way up high, there's a land that I've heard of, once in a lullaby. Somewhere over the rainbow, skies are blue, and the dreams that you dare to dream really do come true. Someday I'll wish upon a star and wake up where the clouds are far behind me, where troubles melt like lemon drops away above the chimney tops. That's where you'll find
WJCT and Vistar Credit Union are honoring the legacy of Fred Rogers with the 17th annual Mr. Rogers Sweater Drive. The drive runs through November 30th and accepts new and gently used sweaters, jackets, and blankets. Contributions may be dropped off at WJCT, all Vistar Credit Union branches, Sedith Moving and Logistics, and the Tom Bush family of dealerships. For more information, visit wjct.org/events. Contributions will be donated to area nonprofit organizations.
I'm David Luckin, host of the Electro Lounge, inviting you to join me Tuesday nights at 9 for Turntable Tuesday, only at the Electro Lounge on 89.9, your community, your world, your music.
Welcome back. Well, he has spent some 3 years now documenting Jacksonville and its citizens through the lens of his camera. Talented local photographer Tony Smilagich, I always mess your name up. Tony Smilagich has put his amazing photos into a new book. The book party is coming up on Small Business Saturday. We've got a preview now as he joins us with more about Create Jax. Hey, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
So it's so exciting to see that your work is being celebrated in a new book. People see you all over town taking pictures. They know how talented you are. Tell us a little bit about this work and this book.
Sure. Well, Create Jax started when I moved back from New York to Jacksonville, and it was kind of the transition from fashion into figuring out how to incorporate fashion still in the Jacksonville market. So I started documenting the art walk, but mainly the street style from art walk. And from there, I started meeting museum people and people who were opening galleries like Space 42 or Space Gallery or whatever else was happening. And I just started kind of meeting more people, going down that path and taking pictures as it kind of went on. So after a few years of doing this, I had enough images where I was like, this should definitely be put together in a cohesive way for people to at least remember that 2 year period, because it's covering 2016 to 2018 of kind of the cultural boom.
You've captured the street energy, the artists and creatives, and more. How would you describe the aesthetic of your photography?
It's focused on people. I mean, it's focused on showing the best side of people, not just people, but the events and how people enjoy those events or how they view those events. Just kind of giving the person who doesn't have time to go to these events, or they're moving to Jacksonville, or they're thinking about visiting Jacksonville, kind of giving them a feel of the community here and, you know, showing them that we are an inclusive space.
And this book is called Introducing Jacksonville to Jacksonville. So yes, when people look at it, they will see some stuff they might not have seen before.
Absolutely. And people who have lived in Jacksonville their entire life, who constantly approach me, or I see them out, or I talk to them over dinners, and they're like, I can't believe these things are happening in Jacksonville. And I'm like, that's all I'm here for is,
to document it. Now, you did a crowdfunding campaign for this book, didn't you?
I did.
How'd that go?
It went well. I don't know how to even process it. I'm still a little numb from everything that's been going on, but I had to collect $15,000 for the Indiegogo and ended up hitting over $17,000 for...
Excellent. Why do you think there was so much support? There's a lot of love for you in this town. I think that's part of it.
Yes. I think when you give yourself to the community responds back. And I think Jacksonville is really good about doing that. Whoever supports the community in general, not just me, but everyone I've seen and all the people I've supported throughout the couple of years I've been here, you see it reciprocated all the time.
Yeah. So with all of that said, you're going to have a fabulous book party launch pretty soon here at the end of the month. It's going to be on Small Business Saturday, is my understanding. Tell us what's happening.
Yes. So Small Business Saturday, they're bringing everything over to Springfield. So they're trying to activate Springfield for that Saturday. So Bobby Kay and Main Events will be having their thing. Malcolm Jackson is releasing his gallery exhibit with 8103 Clothing. I'll be doing mine at Brick and Beam. So it'll be kind of a collection, and more details about the actual collection will start coming out in the next few weeks as it develops, but my actual event will be from 3 to 6 p.m. at Brick and Beam, and you'll have music from Giella, you'll have drinks from Manifest Distilling, there'll be an art installation by a Slightly Off.
And they can get a signed copy of the book.
Yes, absolutely.
This is a perfect holiday gift for that person in your life who is from here or recently moved here. It's really a good gift for anyone's coffee table, I think.
Yes, I agree. Push it that way.
And again, so mark your calendar then for Small Business Saturday, which is Saturday, November 30th, right after Thanksgiving, right after Black Friday, when Tony Smilagich debuts his new Create Jack's book. It's called Introducing Jacksonville to Jacksonville. Come on out to the book party at Brick and Beam. They are located at the corner of Main and First in historic Springfield. It's a great new venue. You may have gone to this in years past when it was something else.
The Pearl,
exactly. Yes. Now it is Brick and Beam, and it has been reborn as a really cool event space. And as Tony mentioned, Main Street is going to have a really interesting Springfield experience that afternoon and evening up and down the street with the local business owners. So there's going to be a lot happening. This is a great way to come out and support not just Tony's work as a local creative, but also on Small Business Saturday, support the small businesses that are really starting to liven up Main Street, like Bobby Kay and his locally produced fashion designs, the 1748 Bakehouse, Crispy's Pizza, Hyperion, Strings, a few other places that are open there, Main and Six. It's so exciting, and I'm biased because I live in Springfield now, but there's a lot happening, and so I just encourage everyone to come on out and check it out.
They're also moving it. It won't be just Main Street. They're also trying to incorporate the Pearl Street shops as well, so Auntie Peach's and...
Very nice.
Right, so yeah. All of them.
So come on out to Springfield on the 30th. Come out for Porch Fest, too, but we'll talk about that on Friday. And Tony Smilagich, thank you so much. Congratulations, and we'll see you in the pages of this book. I'm in the book, so I have to talk about it. I'm excited. I'm honored to be in it. So thank you again for that.
Thank you so much.
Okay, a quick break, and in a moment, how one new cafe is making a big impact in Northwest Jacksonville. That's after this. You're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9. Don't go away.
And what a time it was, it was. A time of innocence, a time of confidences. Long ago it must be, I have a photograph. Preserve your memories, they're all that's left you.
Grammy-winning violinist James Ennis has been called ferociously virtuosic. I'm Courtney Lewis. You'll hear that virtuosity when Ennis joins the symphony and me for Edward Elgar's beautiful violin concerto on November 15th and 16th. Tickets and more at jacksymphony.org.
Amazon has lost a massive defense contract to Microsoft called JEDI. It's the project to move the U.S. military to the cloud. Now Amazon is expected to go to bat with the Pentagon over this decision.
A year ago, there was an 80% chance Amazon's going to win the deal. They were popping the champagne, getting ready to win.
What happens next? This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world. There's no
one now. I'm Jeremy Hobson. Singer Billie Eilish's brother produced her music and is a musician in his own right. We'll talk with 22-year-old Phineas O'Connell about his first solo tour.
When you're young for your category of profession, the thing you really don't want to be is good for your age.
That's next time on Here and Now.
This afternoon at 1 on 89.9 WJCT. Because the way you love me, I could
drink the river dry and still... Kickstarter launched 10 years ago, helping millions of people fund movies, businesses, and new products. What does this part of the new economy tell us about the old one?
This is the most profitable period in American history, and 43% of Americans can't afford their bills. And this is happening during the boom time.
Kickstarter co-founder Yancey Strickler and his manifesto for a more generous world. Next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, finally, this hour, it's a brand new restaurant opening. The Rockin' Waffle Cafe just opened its doors in Northwest Jacksonville. This is a cafe where great music, delicious food, and social impact all come together to make a beautiful sound. They're celebrating not only food, but also African-American music history. Shanna M. Carter is founder and CEO of Crumpin' for Success. She has Rockin' Waffle as one of her company's initiatives. And she's going to give us a little taste of what it's all about. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
This is so exciting. People in Northwest Jackson near Moncrief and Myrtle, thanks to you, have a new and much needed option for delicious food. Tell us about Rockin' Waffle Cafe.
Rockin' Waffle Cafe is one of our initiatives up under our nonprofit because we want to support young people 16 to 24, providing them with training certifications and also a small stipend to kind of keep them focused and give them something that they can look forward to after high school or if they don't want to go to college.
Feeding the community in more ways than one, then.
Yes, yes, yes. And then also we focus on, like you said, music. All the African Americans that were in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So when you come, you don't just get a shrimp and grits, you get a Louis Armstrong.
Nice.
So we're teaching the community also. So when you come in, you're getting educated and knowledge because most of them don't know that.
So this is an entrepreneurial incubator for all the culinary needs of young people. You're also hoping to attack the problem of food deserts in the city.
Yes. So we wanted to provide something fresh, new, also some healthy options, not just foods that they will be typically used to. And all of our things are made in-house. So you're getting fresh products. You're not getting products that are frozen.
Right. So it's called Rockin' Waffle Cafe. I'm guessing chicken and waffles is on the menu.
Yes, we specialize in chicken and waffles, specialty waffles. You can get a pecan waffle, a red velvet, which is our Stevie Wonder. That is a big hit. People love the red velvet waffle. But also with those waffles, all of our syrups are made in-house. So you're not getting all the unhealthy products within syrups at the store.
What else can people have at Rockin' Waffle?
Oh, some of our other specialties are our Bo Diddley, which are our chicken wings and our Parmesan garlic fries. So that's a real big hit. And then you can get breakfast all day. So not just breakfast in the morning. So you can get breakfast from 8:30 a.m. to 7 p.m.
Nice. Okay. So this is, it sounds like it's a mix of traditional kind of soul food, but with a modern twist and the music piece. And the incubator piece.
Yes.
That sounds like a winning combo to me.
Yes. That's what we wanted to do, not just provide for the kids, but also the community when they're coming in. So I love to see the people's faces once they look at the menu and they start giggling and laughing and talking to other people that are there also that they may not know. So they all talk about history, looking at the walls and the pictures and things that they didn't know. So it's like a very good atmosphere.
That's great. And this is just one of the initiatives your company has going, right?
Yes.
What else are you working on?
We do youth entrepreneurship. Our focus is to open a school soon, a business academy for all males, where they can get education all the way through high school and business knowledge. But also we are working to implement other programming and areas where young people can get a stipend for running several different businesses. So giving them that business experience.
Wow. This is just so amazing. And my kudos to you, Shanna. And what I would encourage everyone particularly if you've never been to this neighborhood, go and check out the Rockin' Waffle Cafe, now open at 3416 Moncrief in the heart of Northwest Jacksonville. Founder and CEO Shanna Carter is making it happen. So thank you so much for sharing all the delicious details with us today.
And thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. And that's our show. Thanks for listening. Thanks to all of our guests and callers, too. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Michelle Corum is our director. And Jessica Palumbo is our news director. Bill Wartsfield runs our digital operations here in the newsroom. We always want your feedback. Send those emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for being with us. If you're listening to our rebroadcast tonight, just keep listening for some more great music. We'll be right back here again in the morning. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.